Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Justice of the Supreme Court. I'm reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is a case of Paul E. Weber, who was arrested on August the 30th of 2004 on a charge of attempted robbery first degree and attempted carjacking first degree. A jury trial was held, and it started on March the 17th of 2005. And the defendant was found guilty of those charges. And on March the 26th of 2005, where he was committed in lieu of bail or revoked bail, and that's where he has sat thereafter. The state, after the conviction, filed an habitual offender petition. Thereafter, there was several sentencing dates, and there's motions going back and forth. The original judge in the trial recused himself on February the 28th of 2006. And then on
Do we know why the judge recused himself?
Yes.
And what's the reason?
Basically, I have had issues with the judge and several times. In this indication, there was another incident that happened with another defendant as far as a case review. There's also his wife.
Well, is this all on the record?
The recusal was on the record. There was a letter that basically, it gets a little bit
complicated. Well, here's my question. And the recusal came 14 months after the judge had it under advisement.
That's correct.
And did the recusal have anything to do that preceded the commencement of that 14 months, or did it the basis for the recusal occurred during that 14 months?
The basis of the recusal occurred during the 14 months and, in a sense, did not involve this case.
And how long into the 14 months did the factual basis for the recusal develop? Or, in other words, after whatever led to it, how long?
I would say within about 30 days.
So then that would mean for 13 months after the event that precipitated the recusal took place, the judge took no action in entering the recusal.
That's correct.
Okay. Go ahead. Thanks.
That's fine.
Did you make any application for recusal?
No. I did not make an application for recusal. The recusal was sua sponte. Basically, it was done on the record. And the judge called us in. I have the date for that. February 28th of 2006.
Okay. In any other case, have you applied for recusal?
Not formally, no.
Okay.
Was the to follow up on Justice Holland's question, was the factual basis for the recusal one that existed at the beginning, or did it evolve over the 13 months?
The actual factual basis for the recusal evolved within 30 days of the recusal.
So do we have any reason why the recusal was not entered for 13 months?
No, maybe I misspoke.
Well,
I was saying that
14-month period.
Right.
And at the end of the 14 months, the recusals entered. My question is, was the factual basis for the recusal known on day one of the 14 months? And I understood your answer to be that 1 month into the 14 months was the factual basis.
No, I guess what I was saying is that the factual basis occurred within 30 days of actually he's recusing himself, I'm sorry.
Right, so he had it under advisement for 13 months. Then the factual basis for the recusal occurs, and within 30 days he enters his recusal.
That's correct.
Okay.
So it was in the 13th month then, not
roughly,
the first month, right?
Yeah, I don't know the exact date. It basically was within 30 days of recusal, the exact time period. I don't know at this point in time. There is a letter that he submitted in the record, which was his basis for the recusal.
All right, well, that answers my question. Thank you.
Thereafter, I guess, on another judge took his place ultimately, finally, on January the 11th, 2008, basically, Mr. Weber was sentenced to 27 years in jail. During that period of time, there were, in my account of the record, six different sentencing dates before he was ultimately sentenced. The appeal in this case involves several different issues. One of the issues involving is basically the allegation or the contention that the appellant didn't obtain a fair and impartial trial because of different things that happened within the trial. One of the things that happened, or a series of things that happened, was that there was at least three ex parte communications with the jury that occurred.
Did you know those were happening?
Yes.
Did you object?
Basically, what we were told the first day is that he was going to inform the judge or the jury about it, and he brought in a court, at least on the record, he said he brought in a court reporter and that they were going to be transcribed. Basically, if the indication was that we were talking simply about procedure and what was happening in a short conversations, and there was a record of those things, then we knew what was going to be so that we can look at it. Come to find out, there is no, or at least there is no record of the first ex parte communication, even though on the record he says, I'm going in with a court reporter.
Were they transcribed daily and given to you?
No. No, this, unfortunately, well, financial reasons, certainly it was not a case that we could get daily record. So I had no indication that the transcripts did not exist until we ordered the full transcript and we got what we got.
Well, I must have misunderstood you. I thought you said the judge told you, I'm going to meet with the jury out of your presence with a court reporter and I'll have it transcribed. Therefore, you, the attorneys in the case, can read the transcription. That would lead me to believe there would be a daily transcript and you could make a contemporaneous objection if you were concerned about the interaction with the jury. But it seems like the judge was going to interact with the jury during the course of the trial, give you the transcripts if you ever ordered them, and then based on what you saw in the transcripts, you could make an appropriate application.
Your Honor, basically what he had indicated is that, and I guess it's in the record, that he was going to take a recess. He was going to take the court reporter into the jury room. And he was going to, my understanding at the time, was talking about procedurally. In other words, we didn't have another witness, so he's going to recess until the next day. We did not get a transcript, if anything, didn't order a transcript until the final conviction and the appeal. So we had no indication of what was being told in there.
Was there any explanation of his rationale for going into the jury room rather than bringing the jury out in the courtroom and telling him in front of everyone what he had to say about the procedure?
Not that I recall. He was basically, this was what he was going to do, and that was it. There was no real discussion of it. Basically, he was going to go in, and that was it.
Well, in your experience, had that ever happened with any other judge on the Superior Court?
For the most part, no. There are indications that sometimes a judge will go in to say, we're recessing until tomorrow without the necessity of bringing in, and that's it. Most of the time, it's done through the bailiffs. But this was something that this judge did, at least in this case. I'm not sure I can say in any other case, but in this case, he did what he did. Normally speaking, that doesn't happen, and there's reasons why it doesn't happen, why we wouldn't be arguing about it here, obviously. But the first day, we have no idea what he said to the jury because we could not find a transcript. We attempted to find a transcript. Their indication.
But we do have his statement as to what was said to the jury, right?
Not to the first day.
So there's no record at all?
Other than the fact when he leaves, he says, I'm taking a recess, I'm going to the jury room, I'm taking the court reporter with me.
But no explanation as to what he was going to say?
My recollection as far as the thing, it was for scheduling because we were at the end of the day. And he was going to let the jury go and tell them that they would have to come back on whatever the next day, at whatever time it was.
And do we have an explanation in the record as to why there is no record? Did the court reporter lose the notes or what?
We attempted to locate it or find, and nobody could indicate why. The other issue is obviously because we're going back by the time the request was being made recently, and I guess 08, had already 2 or 3 years had passed, so they couldn't find any record of having anything that day in the jury room or anything. We were told that what we got is what we got, and that's all we have. We then have, I guess, the other indication as far as there was two other times when he talked to the jury. One time, basically involving scheduling, and there's a transcript of what happened. Now, in that case, what's missing is after what happened at the trial is that there was an issue as far as whether we were going to go late or not going late. And the indication was he was going to ask the jury whether we could or could not go late. And during the trial, I indicated that I had a real estate settlement that night and that I couldn't, but if the court wanted to me, obviously we had to reschedule it. So he went to the jury room, and there was a transcript of what occurred, and the jury wanted to come back the next day. He then, from my recollection, came back to the courtroom and said, this is what happened, and he made some statements. Which were not transcribed. Apparently, there is no record of that as well. So we have
he's
the
in the courtroom making the statement, and there's no record of it.
There's no court report or record. Now, I don't. It's in the new courthouse. I think they call it real time when everything is recorded. I think that was in play, but I'm not positive. I don't know if there's a tape of this or not.
At some point, are we going to get to what the impact this has on the fairness of the trial?
Well, I can tell you what my recollection of what happened when I came back, and that basically he told us in the courtroom that he told the jury that that we couldn't finish, that he basically said that one of the reasons was is that defense counsel had other things to do and was more important than this case. Now, whether he said that to the jury, obviously it's not in the record. But that's what he told us at the time.
Is that on the record?
What he told us? In the,
yes.
No. There was no, that we could not locate the transcript of that as well.
Did you make any contemporaneous written documentation that that's what you were told?
No, I did not.
So it's your recollection versus whoever else may have been in the courtroom at the time?
Well, the court reporter in the court says it never happened. They never went back to the court. So there's an indication whether that happened or didn't happen, but
I'm referring to what the judge said that was unreported when he came back into the courtroom. If indeed he said, I told the jury that we couldn't go on because defense counsel had something that was more important than this trial. Unless I'm confused, you just told us that's what the judge said in your presence and in the presence of everyone else in the courtroom.
That's correct. That's my recollection.
So my question was, is your recollection versus what anyone else who was in the courtroom at the time may have recalled, correct?
That's correct.
Do we know what their recollection is of any of those other people might have been?
No, we do not know.
Have you attempted to reach a stipulation with trial counsel or the state as to what occurred off the record?
No. Basically, the prosecutor involved was Steve Walters. He has, I guess, since retired. I've talked to him about this before, but not since the appeal was filed.
You understand that under our rules, there's a procedure to reconstruct the record by having counsel stipulate to their recollection, then have it signed off on by the Superior Court judge. Are you aware of that provision in our rules? In lieu of a transcript?
I think there, yeah, I recall, I mean, I can't recite the rule exactly, but I do recall there is a rule of that, but no, that was not done.
Well, is one of your applications, proposed remedies, that we remand this to make a record of what happened in all of these off-the-record conversation?
I think there should be a record, but there is another one that I think comes into play, and I think there's sufficient evidence or sufficient material that you have in front of you now to simply say that there is so many different errors that were done that the defendant was not given a fair trial. And if you look at the next issue where we had ex parte criminal.
Stop for a minute. You're not asking us to remand for findings, you know, as to what was said in the courtroom. You're content to rely on the record as it is.
Content to rely on the record as it is right now, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Well, how do we decide whether it's fair or not if we don't know what was said?
Your Honor, the next, and I think I can answer that question if you look at the next ex parte communication that occurs. And in that communication that occurs, that is recorded. And that's the morning of the fourth day of trial, where the judge goes in to the jury and says the statement that he says, and I guess it's on page 11 of my brief and the transcript. He then comes in the courtroom thereafter and says to us what happened in the jury room 2 minutes before, which is completely different than what the record says. Because what he says is that I went into the jury room and made a couple of jokes, told them I attempted to make a couple of jokes, told them that I got tied up, and one of the jurors said it was getting close to that two-year point. One other juror who's worked in the retail outlet, I said, you don't have any weapons, do you? She says, not yet. I think they are okay. Mr. Kilroy said they are pretty decent humor. Now, that's on the record. That's what he says that occurs in his ex parte communication with the jury. One of the issues is that Mr. Weber is accused to have a gun in this alleged carjacking, and he brings in his weapon, so that's prejudicial. The other problem is that's not what happened. Well, from the record, that's not what happened. So either the record is incorrect as far as what happened in the ex parte communication, or he is incorrect in telling us what happened, or there's another conversation that occurs. So to answer, yes, I would think that, and again, I'm not sure outside in the jury room, there is no real time, so we don't know. Now, I guess we can try to determine what happened with the court reporter or whatever, but there's really, I don't think, any real way to recreate what happened in the jury room. We can recreate what happened in the courtroom with people there, and that's fine. So that's why I'm saying I'm not sure you need to remand to get a record, because I think there's sufficient stuff to establish that something was awry through everything.
Well, can you articulate what you're identifying as reversible error? You seem to be saying the record we have reflects the judge tried to make a joke with the jury about a weapon, and because the trial involved allegations concerning a weapon, the attempted humor is reversible error. Is that your position?
Well, certainly that's one of the positions as far as what happened. The other position is as far as fair and impartial jurors and so forth, that the communications that this judge was having with a juror on at least three separate occasions was almost making light of the whole trial, in that this man was facing serious time in jail. He got 27 years. That's because he didn't go habitual on the other one. He could have faced 50 years or more. So it's clearly improper for a jury or a judge to have ex parte communications in front of a jury without being a record or having an opportunity to say what was said to him.
Well, there are two issues there. One is we don't have a record. We can deal with that. The other is, to the extent we have a record, it reflects reversible error. And I'm just trying to understand your argument. As I understand your argument, based on the record we do have, we see first that the judge was making light about weapons in a criminal trial that involved weapons as an allegation. And second, the judge was joking with the jury in what we see reported on the record. And it's inappropriate for the judge to joke with the jury at all when the trial involves serious criminal charges. Is that an accurate statement of your two positions?
Yeah, I would say that's an accurate statement of the two positions. Okay. You know, I guess there was other things that basically, as far as the impartiality or unfair trial, involving statements throughout involving, I guess, me, and also on not allowing us to get into presenting a driver's license, and I guess the lesser included. But I think if you look at everything in commute of whatever happened in the whole trial, our argument is that he was not given a fair and impartial trial, and that it should be reversed on that ground. We then have the other issues involved with the habitual offenders, and we briefed that. And we have the issue as far as the speeding sentencing, as far as the three-year delay.
And on the habitual offender issue, if there's a guilty plea entered and that becomes the basis for the conviction, so there's no appeal or right or waiver, if there's a waiver of the appeal, can that conviction be used or not under your argument?
I think under our argument, yes, if he pleads guilty and he admits it, then it can be used. In this case, there was a trial. He was found guilty. He was sentenced to 30 days in prison with nothing else. He did file an appeal because he wanted to appeal it, not through me, through public defender. That appeal was, dismissed. Jurisdictionally, this court basically, because under our Constitution, it's not every felony. A felony has to be more than 30 days.
Is there any remedy under Rule 61?
I don't believe so, because he was not in custody. He was only given 30 days, so I don't know.
He was in custody for the 30 days.
Right? Well, I guess by the time this court denied his appeal, he was already out. The 30 days would have been, 30 days to appeal. During those 30 days he appealed. By the time it was dismissed, he was already out of jail, I guess. Again, I wasn't involved in thereafter. That was a public defender that was dismissed, and we came about of it afterwards with the habitual offender.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, I'm sorry.
May it please the court. For the record, Kevin M. Carroll, appearing on behalf of the state. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Paul Weber was given a fair and impartial trial here. In reference to any improper ex parte communications with the jury in this case, the state would submit, touched on ministerial matters, not matters of substance, and the absence of any prejudice to the defendant would eliminate any claim of reversal here.
What about the theory that beyond discussing when they were going to retire for the night or when they would start the next morning, there were aspersions that one of the reasons they couldn't finish was because defense counsel had something more important to do, or secondly, that there was a joke made while discussing the procedure that you've identified that involved discussion of a weapon, and this was a trial that involved a weapons offense. Can you tell me how that doesn't have anything more to do with prejudice than simply discussing procedure in the trial?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think one of the concerns is something the court has highlighted, the absence of a record regarding the claim that the trial judge somehow disparaged defense counsel by saying that he may have had someplace more important to be. Regarding the claim that the jokes were improper, Your Honor, the state would submit that nowadays we ask juries to check a lot of things when they come into the courthouse. And at this point, they're taking off their belts as a security precaution. The record does reflect that the basis for this one communication took place at about 11:38 in the morning. The jury was asked to be there at 10 a.m. The judge went in there, and it appears from the record, to the extent it does exist here, that he was trying to make light and trying to cool the jury's head.
Why isn't that something the judge could have done with the jury in the courtroom?
I don't know if it wasn't, Your Honor. He certainly could have done it. I don't think there was anything wrong about that. And I've seen it where judges have brought juries in and have instructed them, listen, there was a delay. It's not attributable to anyone else.
I don't think Justice Holland's suggestion is that bring him into the courtroom mm-hmm. might have been the wrong way of handling it. Let's flip that coin. Let's assume what we're looking for is what in the world is the reason for the trial judge going into the jury room with or without a court reporter for any reason.
I don't have a reason for that, Your Honor. There are times when the judge, as the authority for maintaining decorum and the function of a court of a courtroom, should be able to communicate with the jury as to matters of just procedure and ministerial matters. That's recognized by this court. The idea that we'd ask a jury to forego any attempt at levity, I think, is asking a lot of them, especially in a highly charged situation like this.
So levity is more important in a highly charged situation?
I don't mean to suggest that, Your Honor, but I mean to suggest that I don't think that this court's expectations and what's expected by the Constitution would necessarily require a jury to check that at the door when they become officers of the court.
That's not the point. The point is, in order to be able to make any judgment about whether a trial judge has abused his or her discretion, we need to know what happened. And if a trial judge wants to take the extraordinary step of communicating to the jury, procedure or otherwise, it should be in the courtroom where everyone knows what's going on and why, and there isn't any second guessing about the extent to which that communication was untoward, caused an unfair prejudice to the defendant, disparaged defendant's counsel, joked about a weapon in a case where a weapon was integral to a conviction for a crime that was punishable up to 25 years in prison.
Yes, sir.
But what do we have to review here? What can you help us with?
Your Honor, in this particular case, it's my understanding, and the state is going to the state will rely on its briefing to parse apart the conversation at issue here. There are three conversations at issue. One took place on, if I'm not mistaken, the 18th. And that's the one where there's no record that exists about that. And Your Honor brings up a great point about this, that it should be an open court where a record can be made contemporaneous to the actual occurrence. At the same time, the state would suggest that in the case where a judge does go back and have communication with the jury as to ministerial matters, coming in and informing counsel on the record afterwards about that may be another way of doing that. And at that point, it will allow defense counsel or the state, either party, to present any objection to any contact between the court and the jury at that point.
Well, your answer assumes that having the judge alone go in and communicate with the jury is an acceptable way of communicating with the jury. As the Chief Justice said, we're focusing on the other side of the coin, which is why shouldn't the judge always communicate with the jury in the courtroom on the record, even with regard to scheduling?
I don't mean to, I'm certainly not in a position to pass a judgment on or make assumptions about the propriety of the trial judge's actions here. But the trial judge,
well, but my
trial
judge, why shouldn't the judge do it in the manner that I suggested in my question?
Certainly, Your Honor, that may be best practice for judges in those situations. But there also may be circumstances when something comes up out of the blue where a judge may have to go back there. And with the presence of a court reporter and creation of a record.
That wasn't this case.
It wasn't, Your Honor. But the problem with adopting a bright-line rule like that prohibits all contact between the judge and the jury is that it may not allow for the flexibility where flexibility may be required.
It's not Justice Allen's question, nor mine, are suggesting a bright line rule that prohibits judges' contact with the jury. Mm-hmm. What we're troubled by is that a judge would have contact with the jury apart from the participants in the trial that's going on and outside the presence of a court reporter who can take down exactly what the judge has said to the jury. So there's some post-trial mechanism for deciding whether the judge has either committed an error of law in doing so or has abused her discretion in doing so. Under these circumstances, we have a sort of an inarticulated mishmash of possible combinations of events over three or four times that are now alleged to have disparaged counsel, joked about a weapon in a serious case, and or at least it's been argued to us in some fashion that it's impugned the integrity of the judicial process. Now, how do you respond to that?
Your Honor, I would suggest that the absence of the record and the absence of defense counsel's objections to what was happening, that the record, to the extent it does exist here, seems to imply that the defense counsel was aware would prove fatal to any claim that the defendant was prejudiced in such a way to call the entire proceedings into question.
Okay, let's get to that point. Let's assume everything defense counsel has told us is correct. We've had this ex parte contact with the jury. We're unsure exactly what had happened, but on the best case or worst case, depending on your perspective, given all those facts, tell us why it doesn't impugn the integrity of the judicial process.
Your Honor, I'll rely on something that the state did not brief, but it's common practice, and that's jury instructions. A jury is typically told that they are the sole judges of facts, and nothing that the attorneys say, nothing that the attorneys do, and nothing that the court says or does constitutes evidence and should weigh on their decision process.
Was that instruction given in this case?
Your Honor, in this case, I don't know. It's part of the standard instructions. I would assume so, but without having reviewed that portion of the transcripts, I can't tell you that. If that is the case, then this court has repeatedly said that jurors are presumed to follow those instructions. And if they follow those instructions, there is no harm or error because juries apply the facts to the law as given by the judge on what evidence was presented in an admissible form alone, despite anything else that may have happened.
Well, in your view, does the record reflect or not reflect if there was a reference to a gun in a joking way by the judge?
Your Honor, there does seem to be some indication that there was a conversation. If I may just refresh my recollection with this, it may have been, and I'm not completely sure, that may have been something that the judge said when he went into the courtroom, into the jury room. And obviously you can't infer joking or anything or tone from transcripts, but he did say something to the effect of, hey, you don't have a gun, do you? Again, the state would remind.
Can you point to the record that you're referring to?
I believe it's around appendix page 52, Your Honor, and if I may collect it. Appendix page 54.
And what does it say?
I'm just trying to make sure that this is the right. It's, ladies and gentlemen, it's Mel's fault. How about it's John's fault? We were about to start. I have no great excuse. I do because I was in conference with six attorneys on another case. And I don't believe that this is where it was, Your Honor, if I'm going to go back. I can't find it at this time. It's my recollection that it is in there, that it was something that was recorded, and that there was an after-the-fact comment made by the court to counsel in open court that was transcribed as well. And the other point the state would make would be that at no point during these conversations, it's one view to say that the joke, to the extent it can be construed a joke, touched on the issue of a gun, of a weapon, and that this case involved a weapon. No other way did these communications with the trial judge touch upon substance of law, touch upon their deliberations, or otherwise imply how the jury was to conduct itself in resolving the ultimate factual issues here.
Well, wasn't there a reference that, or at least a statement by the trial judge that may be construed as denigrating trial counsel for the defense?
Your Honor, it's my understanding, if I understand defense counsel's argument, that may have happened, but that wasn't transcribed and there wasn't a record of it.
All right.
Without a record on that, as the court indicated, Mr. Romuna is essentially asking this court to believe him over what may have happened.
Was there any contemporaneous objection made either to that statement by the trial judge or to any other alleged statement by the trial judge?
Nothing I could find in the record, Your Honor.
Okay. I'd like to turn to a different subject for a moment.
Okay.
The habitual offender issue.
Yes, sir.
Does the habitual offender statute give the trial court discretion deciding whether or not to sentence a defendant, a qualified defendant, to habitual offender status?
I don't believe that there is discretion once the predicate felonies have been established, once it's shown. At the same time, I don't think anything about Title 11, Section 4214A, which is the specific subsection that we're dealing with here, lends itself to a collateral attack on the validity of this of those convictions.
Well, the question here is whether at least one of the felonies was the type of felony that would qualify.
Yes, right.
That is to be counted for purposes of the habitual offender statute. And my question is this: it appears that what we have here is the perhaps unusual situation where a felony crime was committed, but where the sentence was for less than $100 or less than 6 months imprisonment. Therefore, there was no right to appeal.
That's right.
My question is, it can be argued that the intent of the legislature was not to count that type of felony conviction, because if that type of felony conviction wasn't important enough to trigger a right to appeal, then how could it be important enough to serve as the basis to enhance a sentence of a defendant? What is the state's position?
Your Honor, the state's position, that Mr. Weber's position and the unique position he finds himself in right now of having only served a 30-day sentence for a forgery in the second-degree conviction does not remove him from operation of the habitual offender statute.
Why not?
Your Honor, the statute is clear. It references any felony conviction, any defendant thrice convicted of a felony. Upon conviction of a fourth or subsequent felony, it is declared an habitual offender. Your Honor, this is a felony, and looking at this court's case law and prior, as well as lease, the word conviction.
So your answer is that the legislature made a distinction between those felony convictions for which there's a right to appeal and for those where there isn't?
I don't think there is, Your Honor. I don't think there is a conviction. I don't think there is a distinction. I think that the General Assembly was concerned with defendants who are repeat offenders. And the state would suggest that a defendant in Mr. Weber's position who serves jail time, who actually does serve a period of incarceration, should not be given the benefit of the doubt where a defendant who doesn't, a defendant who receives a suspended jail term, completes their probationary period, never violates their probation, never serves a day in jail, would nonetheless be subject to the habitual offender statute. But Mr. Weber, if the court were to go down Mr. Romano's path, Mr. Weber, who did serve 30 days on this particular felony conviction, wouldn't be. And I would also just like to complete.
I'm not sure what the import of what you just said is.
Well, Your Honor, see,
If I thought the argument you were making was that the legislature didn't create the distinction that Mr. Romano was asking us to make, and that's the end of the argument.
Yes, right.
But apparently that's not your argument.
Well, no, that is my argument, Your Honor, and I'll leave it at that. And I will just add, regarding the forgery second conviction, there was a misdemeanor conviction as well, and I believe it was for criminal mischief or theft. On that charge, Mr. Weber received an additional 30 days. So it wasn't just a question of him serving a 30-day sentence and that was it. It was actually 30 days for the forgery second and 30 days for the misdemeanor companion charge on that.
And what follows from that?
Your Honor, it's just the idea that he did not just merely serve 30 days. It was actually 60 days. It was more. It was more than just initially meets the eye.
Well,
regarding that,
does that would he have been able to appeal?
No, Your Honor.
So why are you talking about?
Well, I'll leave it at that, Your Honor. The General Assembly hasn't drawn a distinction between felonies that do not surpass the jurisdictional limit and those that do. If the court has no further questions, the state will rest on its briefing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Romano, one of the arguments that you make that you didn't have a chance to address in your presentation was the suggestion there's error in sentencing Mr. Weber as a habitual offender when one of the crimes on which habitual offender status was based was one from which he had no appellate review, and that's the forgery second.
That's correct.
And in your brief, you make that statement, but you don't tell us where's the defect. Justice Jacobs' question of the prosecutor was based on legislative intent. Did the legislature intend that? Is your argument based on either the legislature never intended for that to happen, and tell us why, or B, is there some constitutional deficiency in calling him or declaring him an habitual offender on that basis? Your brief leaves me without a basis for understanding why you think that's improper.
Well, the first issue, I think that when the framers of the Constitution basically did this as far as the appeal right, I'm not sure they really realized at some point in time that abuse an habitual that wasn't at the time. In looking at this and going through, I think Delaware is unique in that I don't think there's any other state that has limited its right to appeal on a felony conviction to someone that is sentenced for more than 30 days. I think that in all other jurisdictions, felonies have a right to appeal, and it's routinely whether they're sentenced less than 30 days or not, from my research and review of it. Additionally, the United States, I guess, courts and the Supremes talk about that for a conviction to be used, it has to pass the constitutional muster, in that basically they have to be represented by counsel if they wanted to have counsel, that basically they have a right to appellate review and so forth. In fact, this court, which I didn't find until recently, and I showed a copy to the state, was Braxton versus the state of Delaware, and that was 479 A2nd 831. And this court, basically what happened was that the defendant was convicted of rape, I believe. He wanted his attorney to appeal. His attorney did not appeal, and he filed an appeal, and it was dismissed. He then basically went, I guess, for, I guess, Rule 61 or 35, and this court seemed to indicate that basically for a conviction to stand, that there had to be in violation of the Constitution, and basically he would have to have an opportunity, have a chance to appeal. And because of that, then basically he should be given some indication as far as allowing the appeal to happen. That,
well, under these circumstances, can you tell us the provision of either the United States or the Delaware State Constitution that has been violated in any case that would support that position?
And are you aware, in answering that question, that the United States Supreme Court has held you do not have a United States constitutional right to appeal at all? So the state doesn't have to give you a right to appeal. It's not guaranteed by the United States Constitution.
I can't say I was aware. I mean, the case law that seemed to indicate is that to allow the convictions to work on for habitual or recidivist, that basically there had to be passed constitutional muster. And the cases that, I guess, what I was talking about was ones I cited, I guess, in the reply submittal brief, I guess, MALENG versus Cook, 109, Supreme Court, 1923.
Okay, we can rely on your reply brief.
Yeah, I believe I talk about different cases okay. that deal with it.
All right.
The other issue...
Well, unfortunately, we don't have time.
Mr. Okay.
Thank you very much, counsel, for your argument. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.